I'm John Atack, and I am absolutely delighted to welcome Sean McCraney. Hi, Sean.
Hello, John. How are you, my friend?
I'm in good shape. How are you, my friend?
I am in less good shape, but I am mentally here.
Mentally is the life of the mind. There's a
Yeah, it's a
wonderful little book by Schopenhauer, and that makes me sound clever, doesn't it? Which I is about how to be happy. And it starts out with him explaining, I've explained that life is pointless and miserable, and now I'm going to tell you how to be happy. And
Yeah.
you can just put it in one line. He says the life of the mind, you know, that
Yeah.
whatever's going on out there in the world, we have the life of the mind, and we can read Schopenhauer and spending 100 pages telling us something that we can put in one sentence. So it made him happy though. So, you know, let's not dismiss it, you know.
A fascinating character. Boy, what a mind.
Yeah, and I mean, and not really looked at because Nietzsche sort of came afterwards and got us all in rather a pickle ultimately,
Yeah.
and you know, but Schopenhauer's the first, and I have not read any other Schopenhauer. Let me quickly say that, but he's the first person to connect to Hindu ideas by reading the Upanishads, and saying, oh, we could look at life a slightly different way. I think his notion of the will and all of that is it's interesting and
Yeah.
beyond my grasp, I'm afraid.
Yeah, well,
Yeah,
mine
exactly.
too.
Yeah, that's us. That's us. So when last we talked, I mean, let me introduce you to anybody who is not aware of you, and they should be by now, let's face it. Sean was born and conditioned to be a human predator, a sociopath, let's say, and then in 1997 had a vision on the road to Damascus roadside, in which he became a Christian, and rather than sort of being born again and everything's fine in my life now, Sean struggles every day to find empathy and to behave in a good way. So I think, Sean, that you've given me more insight into this condition than anybody else. And I've read a great deal about it over the last 30 years and more, that to get inside, you know, your, I think, tremendously honest self-perception is really valuable. And for people to understand that there are people out there who really don't care how they feel, you know, who have no empathy and who will do whatever they can to take advantage, and that you're somebody who is, you know, for the most part, you are redeemed. That's the word I liked, that you work really hard to be a good person. And for me, it's been fascinating meeting you and developing this friendship.
Yeah.
You know, understanding that you don't generally trust people and that you
No.
don't generally feel empathy. So, you know, I feel very privileged to spend this time with you. So when we
As well,
last,
John.
sorry,
As
thank
well.
you. Thank you. That's most kind.
By the way, I don't mean to hijack, but just to jump to something I've been thinking about, somebody commented, one of your viewers, that it seemed like I established a defense mechanism to cope with things rather than being labeled a sociopath straight up. And I comment that she or he, I can't remember the gender, may be onto something because that is quite possible. But I again, we kind of have fluid terms about sociopathy and psychopathy and. So I don't know whether it was nature nurture combined or what, but I think there was something to her comment. I thought it was pretty smart.
Yes, I noticed that too. And you said, I think when we first spoke, because I asked you if you thought it was nature and nurture, and you said you felt it was both. And you know, hearing about your mum, it sounds as if there was a certain amount of nurture, just doesn't seem the right word, you know. Let's call it conditioning instead. And I think this is a really important point, because I long ago, I think it was probably Simon Baron Cohen's work on autism, this idea of a spectrum, and introducing a spectrum and saying, well, we're all somewhere or other on a spectrum. And that's true with everything psychologically. So there's an empathy spectrum. And you know, it gets very complicated. I've recently been looking at papers on post-traumatic stress disorder, and there was this startling piece of information that with major depressive disorder, there are 277 possible symptom combinations. With post-traumatic stress disorder, there are 633,000 possible symptom combinations. So you are not, you know, so many things we're dealing with, we'd like them in black and white. So we'd like to say, oh, this person's a psychopath, this person's an empath. Yeah. We are so much more complicated than, you know, these assessments would lead us to believe, I think. And so we're born with a particular hand and we play it a certain way, as many people say. And you were born with a hand that where you couldn't see why, I suppose, you should care for other people.
I
don't think that the Latter-day Saints, the Mormons, helped very much with that.
No.
You commented that looking at the leaders of the Mormons, you saw that they were just like you. They wanted to take advantage of people.
Yeah. And, but it's hard for me to know, is it my, you know, craziness and my emotional makeup that thinks that? And because other people don't seem to think that. They seem to revere these people. I don't revere men.
No. Oh, I couldn't agree more. It's a stupid idea.
It really is.
Yeah. And as soon as somebody's setting themselves up to be an authority or an expert or an authoritarian boss, we are in deep trouble. We really
run.
Yeah.
I'm really grateful for that. And I'm really appreciative of your program and your mind, where you allow that instead of let's just label it and let's just walk on and we can just label. Mm-hmm. I'm glad that there is a spectrum that we can work with. Mm-hmm. And you're not just a pure psychopath or pure sociopath. You know, there's some variance, and that helps me understand it a little bit better, because I do see the sides of me that are fairly normal.
Mm. Yeah, yeah. And I mean, during our first conversation, I found myself in this interesting double bind where I was going, this man is one of the most charming people I've ever met. You know, he has a real charm. And he's telling me, I have no empathy. I don't trust people. And in that first conversation, you explained that as a child, you'd realized that bullying people wasn't enough to control them, that you needed to charm people as well.
That's right.
And that superficial charm is a primary characteristic of whatever we're going to label this personality type.
John, what's the difference? I didn't mean to step on you, but what's the difference between superficial charm and real charm?
It takes us into the area of flattery, a word that means insincere praise.
Ah.
And yet we still say, I feel flattered by that. I feel insincerely praised is not what we mean. And I think superficial charm would be where somebody seems charming, but they're actually manipulating you. Whereas I would say genuine charm, and I think there is such a thing as charisma even, but that is where somebody really does care. And they want to do what they're saying. And I think in our world, it's been, you know, charm has been weaponized. You know, long ago, I think Dale Carnegie is one of the earliest texts where somebody who is quite evidently a sociopath. Carnegie is not there trying to help people. When I first read How to Win Friends and Influence People, I sort of thought, oh, this is a man who knows how to do this naturally, and he's trying to teach other people, oh, this is dangerous, because if you don't do it naturally, you're doing it to manipulate people. Then I came to realize, as I came back to the text, that he was an entirely manipulative human being.
Wow.
So he was, you know, teaching these tricks to other people to manipulate. And that's a big subject for me. I was thinking just before we started talking about public relations and the development, which is a subject I've been fascinated by my whole adult life. In 2015, I helped establish the Open Minds Foundation, and we had a PR agency. And I found myself going, we really have to be very sure that what we're doing is ethical, that because this is a foundation teaching people about undue influence, manipulation, brainwashing, mind control, all those thought reform. And we need to be careful that we're not doing it. And there's a very fuzzy boundary as to, you know, if I know that the color red tends to wake people up and I start using it, you know, this there's a study of sumo wrestlers, and because they wear red, or is it blue? Is it like the Republicans and the Democrats? That we should put the Republicans and the Democrats in the ring and get them to fight it out. That'd be a much better process, I think, than this stupid stuff they're doing now. But anyway, they found that because the sashes are, you don't wear a color as you would in most Western sports, you're assigned the color when you go in the ring. And they found that you had a 5% higher chance of winning if you had a red loincloth on. So once you know that, and you start wearing a red tie or, you know, stuff like that, it's when you've come to know it and you're trying to teach it, how far can you go down that? You know, for example, purr words and snarl words. I have a great friend who did a master's degree, I think, in philology or linguistics or something like that, something beyond me, above my pay grade. And years ago, he explained this difference that they talk about, that there's a purr word like democracy and a snarl word like fascism or appeasement. That's a really strong snarl word, even though what it means is negotiating and coming to a deal. It's associated with Munich in 1938, Neville Chamberlain and Hitler. When Chamberlain successfully stopped the Germans from destroying all of Europe by saying, we've only got 12 fighter aircraft. You know, we're not in a position to do this. And ever after was called an appeaser. But I think I'd be speaking German now if he hadn't appeased Hitler at that point. But the word has become a snarl word. And as the further you wander into this forest, the more you realize that everything we do and how we appear, and this comes down again to things like charm, is it cupboard love? Is somebody doing something because they want me to give them something? And in public relations, where do we separate reason from emotion? Which brings us to the subject that you brought up the last time we were talking, because I said, you know, you can't have a thought without an emotion, and you can't have an emotion without a thought. These are not, we differentiate them when we're talking, but it's not true. And I think you wanted to think out loud about that the last time. I don't know if you, there's a single thought in your head now after I've just talked at you like this, but.
It's not, but when you bring it, I can't tell you the truth. I don't remember even sort of really going into that. But when you talk about it, I have tried to extract all emotion from reason.
Yes.
I've worked very hard to not let, because I am an emotional being,
Me
and my
too.
emotions always lead to destruction. They lead to adultery. They lead to every kind of crime, violence. Reason is my only bastion of hope, and if I intermingle them, man, it's a disaster.
I think it's a matter of becoming as rational as we can, but understanding that all of our thoughts are subjective, and we will tend, you know, to have a confirmation bias to repel anything that doesn't agree with us. And I mean, I got deeply into this because I had 9 years in Scientology from the age of 19 to 28, and I absolutely believed it all. And I have a friend who's an expert on terrorism who uses my work. She gives people a copy of Let's Sell These People a Blue Sky, and has done for years, to say even a relatively clever human being can be completely caught up in a nonsensical set of beliefs. And
Are
that
you
what we.
angry? Are you angry from that?
No,
Were
never.
you ever angry for being so tricked?
No.
How did you get through that, knowing you'd been lied to and manipulated without anger?
Because I felt a tremendous release of no longer having those beliefs. And I the first year I left, and it was great because there were hundreds of people coming to me for help, and I was able to do something. I was able to say, and also it's like this thing about, you know, missionaries who went to foreign cultures and destroyed them with the best of intentions.
Sure.
And I could be sure that what I was doing was good and righteous because I was just pointing at the truth, that, you know, actual information. Very often I was showing where Hubbard contradicted himself. So,
I see.
you know, and finding out the horrors, you know, the awful things that had happened to members of this group, which I'd had no knowledge of. And so anger's it's a really interesting emotion. And it's probably, that's the dividing line. You know, we are theoretically at opposite ends of the scale, though I think you've changed your position significantly, but I have the empathy disorder, and it is a disorder. It's not a choice I made. And it's, you know, where your emotions would lead you to destruction. My emotions would lead me to being destroyed. They'd lead me to being preyed upon. And I think there's the imbalance in our world that people who have empathy are very easy to destroy. Whereas people who are manipulative, Machiavellian even.
Sure.
And how we get the balance there has to be to do with reason. But I can remember, I was 5 years old, and a lad called Brian Terence Grosset, I will never forget his name. I hope he's out there. And I hope he's had a good life. But he got upset with me and he punched me in the face and knocked me down. And I hit my head on a what we used to call a manhole cover. I think we call them person hole covers. I don't know. Work hole covers. I think it's so difficult, all of this, isn't it? But I probably got a concussion and I came up furious. And this lad took one look at me and ran. And it was the first time I'd ever experienced anger. And I didn't experience it again until I was in my 30s.
Wow.
So it's not a natural feeling in terms of what we're born with. You know, I do.
So as an empath, do you, for instance, like you mentioned politics, which I'm not about or know much about, but you will mention politics. So does Matthew Bywater. And so does Trump anger you?
Anger. I make a differentiation. I feel indignation.
Indignation. Okay.
Yeah. I've actually just watched the Comey rule about James Comey, and it is shocking, you know, but in the lead up to the first election, 2016, I watched everything that was available. So I watched more than 20 hours of video, much of it, people who were friends of Trump talking about him. And the picture was, you know, going from the Commodore Hotel onto the idea of having the most successful casino in the world. I think the Taj Mahal was the one of the three that was most, $1 million a day. It still went bankrupt because he set up two competing casinos in Atlantic City in the same place. You go, this is business genius. So I think what I feel more perplexed than anything as to why so many people, and I understand, you know, looking at the corruption of all of our governmental systems. And I think in the US, after the Second War, there was this really mixed combination of ideas, so that even the Marshall Plan to rescue Europe was not extended to Britain, though Britain had given the most to protecting the world. Britain had to borrow money, $4 billion, in fact. Yet Germany and Italy were being funded because of the fear of communism. And Britain wasn't funded because it had a Labour government and the thought they would be socialists, which they weren't really. And so the good and bad intentions, the realpolitik, got so difficult that the US, on the one hand, has probably given more benefit to the world than any other nation ever, and also done a great deal of harm to the world by you know, disrupting democracy, you know, taking out the Iranian democracy in 53, or, you know, the terrible events in Central and South America that are all about protecting an ideal which is not actually being fulfilled by the people who are doing this, you know, that they are the ends justify the means sort of thing. And, you know, the skull and bones Yalies and CIA and all of that. But we're almost forgetting that the threat was very real. The threat of China and Russia, the threat that they'd take the world over, and it's still there. And they're still amazingly dangerous. So is it possible to be transparent and open and decent even in government? We seem to have come to the view most people have that you have to be Machiavellian to be in government. You have to be a sociopath. So Trump becomes an ideal candidate. I'm not at all fond of Joe Biden either. You know, I don't have any preference. I don't trust any of them. How do you tell they're lying? Their lips are moving, you know.
Yeah. Hey, you know, I don't want to lead this. It's your program.
No.
I do want to go back to the how I'm interested that you are an empath toward information, even assault of manipulation that comes into you, whether it be from Scientology. Your response is indignation. Even today, as a somebody who proclaims to follow the spirit of Jesus and peace and love, and I do in most cases, but my family will tell you, if I'm confronted with a manipulation by commercials, colors, any type of propaganda, I get fucking pissed. And I say it because I really do. And I will tell people, you know, with anger, do not try this with me. I'm learning more as this Christian to be able to take somebody who's trying to manipulate me like a Scientologist and give them more love. But that is something I have to try to get more toward the John Attack way. I'm having to move that way. And then it seems like you're having to move my way a bit as well.
I think that's the truth, that we have to have as full an understanding as we can. And I look to consequences. That the thing I learned in Scientology was that Scientology makes enemies. That's how they act. You know, Hubbard would declare somebody a suppressive person, and then they would be fair game. They could be harassed in any way. I knew nothing about that. You know, when I joined, they'd basically withdrawn the use of the term fair game. It caused bad public relations, according to Hubbard, so it couldn't be used. Didn't change anything about the policy. And it's looking to the consequence that if I attack people, they, you know, will fight it out. Whereas if I look to what might help them, not the greatest good for the greatest number, the greatest good for everyone. So my perception of criminal psychopaths, serial killers, murderers, is they can't help themselves and they need to be restrained, but they do not need to be treated unkindly in any way. So, you know, you put the mask on Hannibal Lecter and you keep him locked up, but the revenge motivation, which seems to be so fundamental, and we're not talking here about psychopaths anymore. We're talking about the majority of human beings, Schadenfreude, the joy at another's suffering. And it always bothered me. So if we take that as well as anger, that I don't remember ever wanting to get my own back on anybody. I remember feeling, you know, crushed and disappointed by the awful things that people had done and said to me. But it didn't, it never got in the right. How am I going to get them back? Now, that is fundamental to your way of being. In childhood.
Except that was pre-me. Today, I don't have a bone in my body that enjoys Schadenfreude.
Excellent.
At all. Not a bone, not an emotion. I don't have it. And that's one of the miracles of what I profess. that was taken away, where before I relished in it.
Yeah. And that is, I think that is the fundamental transformation that has to happen in human society, where right. where people actually, you know, see that the humanity of others. And so, I mean, there's this peculiar contradiction. In the US, you have the correctional system, and it's not correcting anybody. It's not about rehabilitation. It's overwhelmed. Far too many people have been drawn into the prison system. So you have the highest per capita prison population of any country in the world, 217 countries. That is a horrible thought. In fact, California the other year moved 85,000 prisoners out of state into other prisons. That's more prisoners than we have in the UK. Wow. And yet our population, you know, we're about 65 million or something. So we're about a quarter, fifth of the US, coastal quarter. So, you know, and our murder rate, you know, there was a point where New York City had 500 deaths a year. The whole of the UK had 500 deaths a year. There is a real difference in culture here. And I think a lot of it is a retribution culture. It's you know, getting people back for what they've done. Do you see the series Oz about US prisons?
Oh, yeah. What's the whole thing?
Yeah, me too. Absolutely compelled and fascinated by what it was teaching me. And you start with a rich guy who's run somebody down in his car, and he's given a punitive sentence to show people, and he is immediately attacked and destroyed and turned into a monster within days. And I think it was such an accurate reflection of what that treatment does. We have we have very little in the subject of psychopathy in treatment, but we do have the Mendota study, which is a juvenile center where they left one group of youngsters. They'd have oppositional behavior, or one of these, you're not allowed to call somebody antisocial until their 18th birthday, and then but blow the candles out on the cake. But so they're kids who'd got one of the three conditions that later are labeled as antisocial personality disorder. And one group had no treatment, just the normal stuff, and the other group were given counseling and compassion and love. And I don't remember the specific statistic, it's in a book, Opening Our Minds. The group that had no treatment went on in the next couple of years to commit 17 murders or something like that, whereas the other group committed none. And this was the first time that it had been absolutely demonstrated in a longitudinal study that you can help people who feel this way, and that some part of it is simply the thought that they're not loved, that they don't have any attachment to other people. They don't feel secure with other people. They can't trust other people. And so and of course, you know, the people who are on the leading edge of this are actually trying to help people. My heart goes out to them. I mean, I'm not sure I could do that. You know,
so in the UK, is the penal system not punitive?
It is punitive, but and it's overcrowded. Just like in the US, you have, you know, white collar and blue collar prisons, if you like, open prisons for people who've committed financial crimes. It's not tremendously healthy. Having said that, there was a documentary series about the Isle of Man, which is its own little state, and they have a higher prison population than anywhere else in the UK, but you get that there's a really friendly atmosphere in their prisons, you know, so people want to go back there. I think it's like really strange seeing the way that the warders actually respond, and then looking at documentaries about some of the American prisons and the viciousness that happens in them. And the polarization that's created, you know, that all of the significant gangs, I think, were formed in prison. They you know, the Crips and the Bloods develop through that. And you now have this terrible problem with tens of thousands of people in these gangs. And you've got people like, is it the Latin Kings? I think that's what they're called. I had this incredible conversation. I was in Lisbon at a conference, and this police inspector came up and talked with me. incredible man. And he was in Barcelona, and he'd been tasked with dealing with the Latin Kings. They'd started coming out of, I think they're from Ecuador or somewhere originally, and I think it's Ecuador, and the US. And they'd started arriving, which meant their rival gang had arrived, and he had to deal with them. And his approach was so different. He went to, I think it's Ecuador, and he went to the US to meet members of the gangs in prison. And he said that his first day in Ecuador was the worst day of his life. He had never seen anything like the brutality in the prison. There were four times too many people in there. And it was all about these two gangs killing each other. And they were treated as animals by the wardens. And then he went to the US and he found the same thing. And so he basically did a dawn raid on the leaders of the two gangs, got them both, put them in a room, and said, right, you've got until the end of the day to sort this out between you. I'm not having any killing. I'm not having you fighting each other here. You make a deal that says this is a safe haven where you're not going to do it. And they did.
Wow.
And he, after that, had been consulted all around the world because he'd managed to calm this problem that nobody else had done anything with by treating them with respect and saying, you are human. This is a nonsense. And, you know, it might be a libtard attitude. There's a wonderful American word. I invented reptard to go up against it, but nobody's adopted it. Sad, isn't it, when you come up with a brilliant word like that?
Yeah.
But I accept that we have to have a balance. We have to, you don't just say, oh, that's fine, you know, go off and do it again. You have to restrain people. You have to do something about it.
It sounds like the solution to the Latin Kings problem came by reason.
Yes.
And it came stripping emotion out of it. Because once the emotion comes in, you can blame each other endlessly and start killing again.
Yeah.
I think reason is so important to even every conflict we have. Try to reason through it and push back. What do you believe that emotion has a place outside? And I agree, it has a place when a family member dies or it's an emotional movie or something. But I mean, shouldn't we try to become far less emotional and far more rational?
Yes, or far more rational, even if we are emotional. And looking at our passions directly. I mean, if you know, you're an artist as well as everything else, that's a part of who you are. You're a creative person. And for that, you need passion and drive. You know, this last couple of months, I have fallen into the music of Gustav Mahler. And I listen to every kind of music. Grew up on rock music, and I listened to swing and blues and, you know, not so much acid house, I must say, but, you know, all sorts of things. And I've loved Sibelius and Stravinsky since I was a kid, and Elgar and stuff like that. But for some reason, having seen Death in Venice, you know, with Dirk Bogarde, where you've got the Adagietto from the Fifth Symphony by Mahler, this incredibly emotional piece of music, I'd heard that and heard it over and over and sort of gone, how wonderful. But something had kept me back from the rest of his music. And coming to it, the emotion, he just pulls you apart. He'll have a funeral march going on, and then he has a children's song going over the top of it. You know, he plays Frère Jacques in the First Symphony. And he's messing with you all over the place. And I think that catharsis is really useful. I think not being driven by emotions, but realizing that we do need to express them in some way. But the passion that comes out as anger in one person can come out as joy in another. It can, you know, there's a huge power there.
Yeah.
If we divorce that from reason, oh, we're in trouble, and how we're in trouble. But, and that has been, I think, the struggle of humanity over the, you know, 2 million years or whatever since Homo erectus first stood up. That we've worked towards, we've done things that One of the things that has most amazed me is the contemporary view of evolution, that the old-fashioned Mendel-Dawkins view, the selfish gene, has been disproven. It's gone. It went in the 1990s. And so younger biologists now talk about four dimensions to evolution, where there are only two dimensions in that model, which are natural selection and sexual selection. We've added to that epigenetics. There's no doubt that changes can happen to genes in a single generation. Genes are not read-only. Therefore, they can't be selfish either. They change and transform. But the fourth dimension is cultural transmission. And we're not the only species that have it. You know, monkeys and apes and crows have been seen teaching their progeny. But we live in it. We have the capacity, you know, all of the stuff in the 90s, I was deeply involved in the, you know, we're 1.7% different from chimps or bonobos, and chimps hit things to control them and bonobos screw things to control them, you know. So I, for, you know, 10 years thought within that, you know, how like that are we, and Conrad Lorenz and aggression and all of that. And then you go, that's all nonsense. It doesn't matter what our ancestors did. It doesn't matter what chimpanzees do, we have the power of thought. We can change our minds. We can therefore change our behaviors. And for me, that was kind of a spiritual liberation. You know, having come away from Buddhist ideas very, very gradually, here was this other way of looking at the world and saying, oh, in real time, every one of us is contributing to the future of humanity. Every one of us is contributing. So it really matters that we feel positively and that we seek to help others, because that'll make us feel better and it will make the world a better place. That eventuates in the view that I don't really believe in my own perpetual individuality. I'm not concerned with an afterlife or anything. I'm concerned with being a thread in the tapestry of humanity, and preferably being a golden thread, you know, doing something shiny and nice, you know, that will do something so that humanity has a future. Because, of course, we are poised on the brink of destruction, as we have been ever since weapons were first invented.
Right. So I had trouble connecting with this thought with somebody else recently. Is in my natural state, you have no concern with the metaphysical side. Is that correct? The spiritual, unprovable side. It's more here and now, right?
I think I'd take Stephen Jay Gould's view, which when he was in fact arguing with Richard Dawkins, that there are distinct magisteria, he calls them. One of them is science, which is, we talked about Zen and the art of motorcycle maintenance the last time we talked. So one of them is quantities, measuring quantities, which is the Aristotelian way of things. And the other is qualities. And I do believe that these are distinct things, and that what we call spiritual fits into the qualia of the mind, the qualities that we experience. But people tend to make fanciful decisions about that. They tend to have emotional decisions about that. But I think reasonably, we exist in consciousness, and that is much more important than our physical existence.
Okay.
How to make sense out of that, I, you know, maybe in about another 1,000 years I'll get somewhere. But
the point I was going to make toward me is that if I didn't, and we've talked about this, if I didn't have the crutch, the experience in 97 on the roadside, by the way, it wasn't a vision. It was just experience. I saw nothing and I heard nothing. But
good to clarify that.
Yeah. If I didn't have that, I don't understand that way of thinking. I don't give a damn if I don't have some kind of tie-in to something bigger than me and future for me and my family and people on this earth. Fuck it. Might makes right. I don't care if it's been disproven or not. And I just don't see any reason why I wouldn't become a drug lord. Murderous Pablo Escobar drug lord to cash in on this time. I don't understand the benevolence in a mind like yours that wants to leave something behind and doesn't believe there's anything in the future. Help me.
Well, I'm agnostic, so I don't know.
Okay.
But reason takes me to the point where it used to bother me. And because my background is Buddhist as a teenager, and because I held those views throughout Scientology and beyond until somewhere over 10 years ago, so into my 50s, I belonged for a year initially to the Soto Zen community. Then I got into Scientology, and I've never connected with any other Buddhist community because I've never seen the point of it. You know, they all seem like cults to me. They all seem that they adopt gurus, and they, and I suppose I came to this interesting point where it's, do I believe out of desperation? Do I believe because I'm afraid? And we've talked about this before, that I have this urge towards the truth. And I think the contemporary understanding of evolution, and the, I particularly attribute that to Eva Yablonka in Israel. And she wrote a book called Evolution in Four Dimensions, which is too complicated for me to understand, I'm afraid. But I think I get, you know, thankfully, one of her pupils, Yuval Noah, is a very close friend of mine. So he's explained over the last, well, not 9 years now, nearly since we met, we've talked and talked and talked. And this positive idea that we can and do evolve. We have made so much. The world in the Western world, in the richer part of the Western world, is so much better than any human situation before. You know, we don't send 4-year-old kids up chimneys or down mines anymore. We have some ethical, we've evolved ethically, I believe. We need to evolve a lot further. We need to stop fighting wars, and we need to stop supporting people who want to fight wars. Because that's really not good for us. So yeah. Mayhem. But that thought of a human community of a habitable and marvelous and beautiful planet, of the wonderful creative things people have done. I mean, curiously, Marla asked exactly these questions. You know, what is the point of my existence if nothing is left behind? He had grown up as a not really non-practicing Jew. He went to synagogue. There's a story about him when he was about 6 years old that he shouted out to shut the cantor up and said, "That's not music." And he's right there with all the people around him. He's 6 years old, and he starts singing a polka. He says, "That's proper music," you know. And I think that was about, he converted to Catholicism because he couldn't become director of the, I don't think he could even get a job as a conductor at the Vienna Opera because he was Jewish. And so he converted to Catholicism, and it said he even once went to church, which was to get married. But he too, you know, Gauguin, "Who am I? Where am I? Where am I going?" His majestic, great work. This perplexity. And I think I just stopped worrying that, you know, I inhabit the eternal now, you might say. I don't know.
I see.
And I feel good most of the time. I feel distressed and upset when people are horrible to me. And recently I have actually suffered something really quite seriously nasty from somebody who I consider to be a friend. But it happens. And I understand that part of it is, it goes back to that charm thing, where people will read me and say, "Oh, he's manipulative. He can't mean these things. He's not really a friendly person." And it, you know, I've disagreed with something that they believe, and they start going, "Oh, well, it's not what it appears to be." But I am as stupid as I look, you know.
You're a sharp guy. This is great stuff. Do you see organized religion as helping society, at least in the way of taking someone like me and helping teach them ways to work civilly and peaceably with others? At least in that sense, don't most religions try to do that?
I don't think so, no.
Oh.
You know, one of my essential studies is the history of religion and belief. Yeah. And it is appalling that religion has been used. I mean, the word itself, ligare, to bind together, as in ligament. Yeah. And so the word religion actually means a social binding force. It doesn't mean anything spiritual, I don't think. And you start with, and this is something that I think we talked about before. When I was 13, I rejected Christianity because I asked the religious instruction teacher, if anybody other than Methodists, he was a Methodist, would go to heaven, and he paused and then went, no. And a week later, and it was a spontaneous question, a week later I said, could God ever forgive the devil? And he said, no. And I'm like, well, I don't believe in your God then, if that's as far as forgiveness goes. And there was a sort of sundering, which was the realization that Christianity was a weapon. It was a way of demanding compliance from people and forcing them to do something, or it could be a means of liberation. So, and I think you exemplify this, that after your roadside conversion, you spent years trying to be part of organized religion and finding that you were frustrated at every turn. Yeah. I think we have to become individuals and be able to stand up to the atrocities. So seeing the scandals, the abuse scandals in the Catholic, the Anglican, the Methodist, the Baptist, Jehovah's Witnesses, seeing the way that people responded to that, Pope Benedict sort of saying, well, we're very sorry, but they're not actually doing anything about it. That's been appalling. And I think that looking at religion becomes a pretense. It becomes a way of, you know, I go to church on Sunday and therefore I'm a good person. And, you know, I have never rejected the teachings of Christ. That's a different thing altogether, that, you know, this brilliant mind, you know, whether it's one man or a group of people bringing together things. You know, we know, for example, that the loving God with all your heart, all your soul, all your strength, that comes from Rabbi Hillel, if Rabbi Hillel ever existed, but it does predate Jesus. We know by looking at the so-called Zadokite documents, the Essenic, the Dead Sea Scrolls, from Qumran, the Bar Achbar Gospels, we know that these teachings were general, but they're pulled together so powerfully. You know, consider the tree by the fruit it bears. I mean, there's a piece of advice for us. You know, don't listen to the bullshit people are speaking. Look at what they're actually doing in the world. And so much else that is powerful. But the traditional Jewish Peshar, which is the Torah, the Old Testament, exists to be interpreted, moved into this is literal truth. And then we'll get to a moment in history like the end of the 12th century when Pope Innocent II decides that the Cathars, the Albigensians in the south of France, which was not France at that time, it was the Languedoc, a separate state, are to be destroyed and annihilated. And the Catholic Church performs its first great genocide at that time. And you're kind of going, so this is organized religion. And the problem is that calculating and Machiavellian people will always take over these groups if we don't have the checks there. And we don't, you know, looking at Hindu nationalism, for example, which rules in India. And you have people marching down the streets screaming, death to non-Hindus, death to non-Hindus, as a part of what they consider to be their religious belief. We have Buddhist monks in Myanmar and Sri Lanka killing people as part of, you know, so it's the organized bit that's the problem. Seeking to understand the truth and our own relationship to the world is important. Accepting somebody else's control and that they're saying this is what it's about, or, and you're kind of going, well, you're more clever than I am, so I'll do what you say, that's the wrong way. Everybody, no matter what their intelligence, whatever that is, everybody is capable of making decisions about their own life, and they should be helped to do that. And those decisions should be what we call pro-social. So yeah. That too is a difficult concept, because somebody has to decide what's good or bad for us to get to that.
I stand shoulder to shoulder with you completely, without exception, on everything you just said about religion. Yeah. Every single thing. I like you said, I tried to fit in and experience that after my roadside experience. But for me, the individual Kierkegaardian leap of faith, surrender self is what saved me.
Yeah.
And the drugs and the psychology and psychiatry and parenting and religion never did. And so we, you know, not to toot our own horn, but we are trying to share what we call the great news, not the good news. Good news was for the Jews. This is something different. And I just think that if we could extract ourselves from authoritarian religious constructs and share with people how there are avenues available if they think there's nothing left that are metaphysical, I think that would be a contribution that I seek to make, because I've experienced them. Yeah.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. It's about how we behave and what we believe. And you used the key word for me, which is authoritarian.
Yeah.
And there's a division. You have authority that comes from expertise. You know about something. So, you know, you're a plumber and you can do the plumbing. And that's proper authority. Then you have authority that comes from rank, because you've been appointed to be the boss. And that is fundamental to our society. Our society developed out of Sumeria, and the idea that God was represented by the king, the divine being. So Egypt,
the sovereign.
Yeah, exactly. And that pattern went out into India and China and Egypt, as Joseph Campbell and others showed. It wasn't part of the collective unconscious that we have to behave that way. In fact, Graeber and Wengrow in The Dawn of Everything, one of the most wonderful books I've ever read, show that just about everything we're taught in school about the past of humanity is wrong. And that the most significant thing is this idea of progress, this idea that we are evolving towards a perfect state. And that has to be within the way that we believe. And they show that many societies have existed that had very different ideas to our ideas. So you have the Indus Valley civilization in what is now Pakistan, which survived for 700 years without warfare. They apparently didn't have kings or priests either. It appears that everybody got to live the same way. The Ukraine, sadly, excavations there were halted, but it appears there was another long-term society there that was fraternal, let's say, though probably sisterly as well as brotherly, who knows. We don't have to have the tribal society, which is what we have, where there's a chief, a king, a boss, you know, the head chimp, the alpha male. We can actually be part of a collaborative society that's for our own good. We aren't at the moment. We're ruled by plutocrats, you know, whether it's Putin, who I think is probably the richest man in the world, or President Xi, or the little pack of clack of people around the principal Democrat and Republican leaders. How we get past that one, I haven't quite figured out yet. I'll let you know if I do. You know,
John, listening to you, this is something we talk about on our end quite a bit. And that is the old school of you have to believe and live like I do that comes from religion, from what I can see from a pretty reasonable, contextual, sound, exegetical understanding of ancient scripture. And I'm calling the apostolic writings, or what people call the New Testament, the ancient scripture.
Yeah.
It pretty much tells us that if somebody exhibits agape love, which is selfless love, that they are his, meaning Jesus, in my estimation.
Sure.
And so what we say is, we don't care about the doctrine. We don't care about the practice or the lifestyle. Do you love? I haven't been able to love until I had him, you know, come into my life. But perhaps, and this is how I would explain John Attack, is he's filled with the love of Christ. He just isn't ready to see him as the one yet. And someday maybe you will. But that's the real Christian message. Do you love? So if a Buddhist loves, Muslim, atheist loves, with agape love, self-serving, I mean, not self-serving, selfless serving, I see that as more of an indicator of God in them than anything else.
Yeah. And I mean, I have several friends who are theologians, and we have very interesting conversations because they don't get upset with me. They're willing for me to, you know, have my idea. And I would say that Jesus, as we read Jesus, the cosmic Christ, is a manifestation, as you say, of love. And we can take it back to a simple idea, which is that the word God is cognate with the word good.
Good, yeah.
And there are many contradictions which exist within the apostolic literature, within the Old Testament. And we have to resolve those, but we resolve them, I believe, exactly as you say, which is, do we have a positive attitude towards humanity? Do we want to? And how twisted does that become? That, you know, for example, when people believe they've become humble, and they're trying to tell us how humble they are, and they're trying to make broad their phylacteries, as it says. Which for anybody who's not sure what a phylactery is, it's a little scroll in a leather pouch. One goes here, one goes on your arm, and it's an Orthodox Jewish form. And making broad your phylactery means showing off when you're praying.
Yeah.
And unfortunately, that is the way of all church, that you're meant to pray in a closet, I believe the man said. You do it privately. And it, you know, there is so much to understand in there. But I think it's a teaching that manifests through many individuals. I don't think Christ is the only manifestation of it, but I think...
Oh, I don't either.
Yeah, no. The, what we might call the Christ spirit.
Yeah.
That love, that forgiveness, and that willingness to sacrifice yourself, which I am trying to get over.
So, oh, yeah. And that's
fascinating. Done enough of that.
Wow. Yeah, didn't Golda Meir say, stop being so humble, you're not that great?
Yeah, probably, but look at her. Warmongers. I was going to talk about...
Do you love warmongers?
No, not really. I think that was a very crucial point for me. I went on an intervention to talk to a young Scientologist in 1991. And I had a really hard time of it. The people I did it with, I'd not done any kind of formal intervention before. I'd talked with hundreds of people who'd left Scientology, but I hadn't sat with somebody who was a total fanatic. And I, you know, and I managed in, you know, it took a day and the guy left and has a successful life, I'm very happy to say, these many years later. I'd not really had a hard cult experience. I'd not been sleep deprived for more than a single night at a time. And I had 5 nights without proper sleep. And then one of the people I was working with turned on me. And it was vicious. It was really vicious. He sought to undermine me and bring me down. And it left me, and my life was not easy at that point. I was really struggling because I was being harassed all the time by Scientology, and you know, my wife didn't love me anymore, and I got 2 kids to try and, you know, I don't know, I hadn't got enough money coming in. You know, the usual things. And I got home from this and I spent about 3 days shaking, I think, from the effect of it. And this thought came up in my mind and it would not go away. And it was, I was taught, I can't even remember how early on in my life it was. It's so early on. I was taught that I must love everybody. Mm. You know, I went to church every week till I was 11 years old and too tired to get up in the morning. My mum had been a Sunday school teacher. She was a lovely person, generally. And this thought came up, you know, you've got to love everybody. And I didn't want to think about it. And through those 3 days, I eventually went, this is an unquestionable assumption. That was the label I put on it. We all must have them. These things that we know are true, but we don't dare think about.
Mm.
Oh, dear. And I thought about it. And ultimately, I decided that, no, I'm under no obligation to love everybody. Mm. I decided the Hippocratic Oath would be, I won't harm anybody deliberately. Mm. And since then, there are people who, I know, the only Scientology has this practice of disconnection, you know, which I'd never done, and I left when they tried to get me to do it to a friend, where, you know, you don't communicate with somebody anymore. You shun them, you disfellowship them, whichever, you ostracize them, you send them to Coventry. And I've only done it once, and it was a guy, I was working on a court case for this guy. And I worked on it for 10 years in the end. And this was while I was still working on it. If it had just been him, I probably would have walked away. My bill was never paid. It was £37,500. I went bankrupt when it wasn't paid. So it was quite significant. I won the case. Scientology walked away. But this guy along the way annoyed the hell out of me. He did all sorts of things. He just said horrible things about me to other people. And I'm doing this work. So I ended up writing him a disconnection letter, and it read, unless you're in trouble and need my help, I don't want to hear from you again.
Yeah.
I'm happy to say I haven't.
But you gave a caveat.
It's true. I shouldn't have done that. But that it's just to say that I don't love that person. You know, that's not my, you know, he's an annoying git.
Well, I mean, love in the agape sense is not, it's always sacrificial. It's always difficult. I mean, other kinds of love are pleasurable. The kind of love I'm talking about is when you disagree with somebody, when they've treated you badly, when they have maligned your character, and you still choose to serve them and not attack them back. Mm. See, here's what I'm thinking as I talk to you. You say that there are limits to your love. I can't have that in my mind.
All right. Yeah.
If I have limits to my love, someone's in danger. Mm. So you can call it the crutch of all crutches, but for a sociopathic person like me, when I came to understand that agape love, selfless love, needs to be extended to all without condemnation, I can judge, but I don't condemn them. Hmm. I was able to then live free of my compulsion to hurt.
Yeah. And yeah, it's so important. And it's interesting that you use the word crutch. I think with Matt Bywater, but I think with John DeLille and Anthony Magnabosco.
Yeah.
And I sort of stopped at that word because I don't think that's accurate. I don't think it is a crutch. I think you have gone through a rational process. Mm. And what impressed me when we first talked was this may not be true for other people.
Yeah.
But this is what I believe. And that was the point where it was like, it's not a crutch there. Therefore,
oh, okay.
It's an aid to living, and it's an aid to understanding, and an aid to loving, and an aid to helping people.
But isn't a crutch an aid? Are we just talking about semantics here?
No, I don't think so. A crutch is an aid so that you can walk properly. But in this case, it's more of an aid in the sense of a tool, in a sense that allows you to do certain things. Hmm. And I didn't, the sense, Anthony Magnabosco, and I'm told he's changed his mind since, by Matt Bywater. Oh. But he decided that he couldn't carry on with the conversation because if he took this away from you, you'd become, you know, horrible again.
Yeah.
And I was sort of, I don't think he's understood who you are.
Yeah.
That this has become a part of your being. So a crutch is an external thing. It's an aid. It's something you do. I think you've internalized this, and I think it's proper and good that you have. And it gives me tremendous hope for the future of humanity, because if you can do that, then it can be done. And we have to, you know, I was thinking about politics and corporations and PR, that it's all Machiavellian. It's all these guides as to how to get people to agree with you and do your bidding, rather than how to liberate other people's thinking so that we can collaborate with one another and we can air our differences and agree on our objectives. And I think that so much of that is an aspect of temperament and character. Eric Fromm has this thing where he says, you know, you're born with a temperament and you develop a character. And, you know, you seem to be developing a pretty good character there. And you've got that great beard, of course. Wow.
Yeah. I got that from Fromm too. Love, I think he tells to. By the way, did you read, I know you like, you've mentioned Eric Fromm, I think, a few times. And I've learned a lot from him about love.
Yes.
Rollo May, have you read Rollo May as well?
The existential therapist. I read some of his work.
I was influenced by him later. I thought he had some good insights. Go ahead.
Yeah, I think with Rollo May I read him first because he criticized Ron Hubbard, and I found in about 1984, I read something he'd written in the 50s about Hubbard, which was spot on. Along with Hayakawa, the general semantics guy, he wrote a brilliant piece about Hubbard and why it can't possibly work. But what disappointed me with Rollo May was he seemed to be saying, your worldview, your Weltanschauung, your paradigm isn't working. Here's mine, which is existential. And that worried me, rather than saying, your worldview isn't working. Here are some ways of thinking about it. So I frequently found myself in a position with somebody who has just shed Scientology. They've just gone, oh, that's a really bad idea. That wasn't helping me. And the first question will be, what do you believe, John? And the answer is, look, my life's a complete mess. You don't want to do what I do.
Yeah. Yeah.
But there are tools towards
that. That's not entirely true, John.
It certainly isn't now. When I was doing that kind of work in the 80s and 90s, it was. But no, my life's pretty good now. But it was a disaster back then.
You know. But today, would you recommend what you have discovered as working to another? Or is that imposing? Is that instead of suggesting, you wouldn't recommend what you've... And that's where I think I'll recommend what I found, but I don't impose it upon you as an imperative.
I think we're both in the same place. You know, and there are particular things, you know, I recommend very specific things. Derren Brown's book, Happy, for example, because he does take a non-spiritual, he's an atheist and a brilliant man. But he says, look, here are the reasons to be cheerful. And his base is the Greek philosopher Epictetus, who I'd not read before then. Mine would be Jiang Su, the Chinese philosopher. That there's this sort of, well, I don't know why I'm here or what I'm doing. Well, I might as well have a reasonable time while I'm doing it. I might as well face difficulties and not get too grumpy about it. You know, that. So there are things that I do recommend to people. You know, I translated the Tao Te Ching by Lao Tzu. And I'd very definitely recommend that. And I recommend my version of it, what's more.
Okay.
Having read 60 versions of it and 50 commentaries over the years, I took it character by character. I did a version in 84 to get my head out of Scientology. And it's amazing looking back at it that it was a Tao Te Ching translated by a Scientologist or a version that you
What's
know.
What's the name
back
of the book?
It's called The Tao Te Ching, T A O T E C H I N. I'll send you a copy of mine. Or that's the way Giles' way of spelling it. Then there's the pinyin, which is D A O D E J I N G.
I've seen that.
Yeah. It's the second most translated book in the world after the Bible. For the New Testament.
Interesting. Wow. That's another subject.
Oh, and how, isn't it? You know, the song of the turtle was heard in the land, as the King James Bible has it. It's a turtle dove, you fool. Not a turtle. They don't sing.
Oh, people go nuts, don't they?
My very close friend Bonnie Woods, who is Christian, we were dealing with Scientology in Chichester, the town of Chichester, and the vicar there had come to us and asked for help, and we managed to close down the Scientology center there. And sadly, there is so much going on in the world, but nobody has come to me to ask how you do that. It's like, I keep saying I closed down two of these places in a matter of weeks. And people instead, you know, you've got a thing in Los Angeles at the moment where they've actually made this street recruiter, Sebastian, famous internationally by protesting. And you're going, that's not the right way. You want to chase the street recruiters back in. And I know how to do that. I did it. But anyway, we were in Chichester and we were in the church and I'd given a talk and he got, I don't know, more than 100 people in there. Very impressive. And afterwards, Bonnie said to the vicar, who was a graduate of Oxford and, you know, this graduate in jurisprudence, in fact, from Oxford, and a very smart man. And she said that she preferred the King James Bible. And he was furious. It's the received word of God, Bonnie. You can't prefer it. And it's sort of, yeah, but it's also the most beautiful piece of poetry in the English language, even beyond Shakespeare, for me. Originating with Tyndale, of course, and his version, and the Bishop's Bible, and then finally, and it's a relief to know that a committee can't write a book, you know, they were just polishing it, you know. But that it is important to understand the poetic majesty of that text, but it's more, it is, you know, I think the vicar's point was it's more important to understand what it's telling you or trying to tell you. And that brings us back to Pesha, the Jewish tradition, which is kind of what hermeneutics in Christianity, but it became very intellectualized. And I don't think it should be. I think we all of us need to interpret and talk about, discuss what these things mean and what we can take from them and how we can use them to help others. So there are texts I recommend, that's for sure. But the conclusions that people make, it's always for me, right from my teens, being, I want you to think.
Yeah.
I want you to decide who you are and where that's going. And having people say, oh, John, you know, that's a brilliant idea and I'm going to adopt it is like, no, that's not the point. It's a way of looking at the world.
Yeah. And that's how I also pursue sharing. For me, in my world, to understand things, I think it's more like art or music or a film, or it's literature. Literature in the sense of fiction. I would recommend fiction to people that has a meaning for them to derive what they get out of it, much more than a nonfiction treatise on how to live.
I tend to agree. Somerset Maugham, the novelist, said that if you want to understand psychology, read novels.
Yes. And Dostoevsky.
Dostoevsky, the first name on the list always. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, forget it. So that way you avoid the, this is objective, you must believe it this way, do that, and let people hear the music themselves.
Yeah.
I'm very big on that.
Yeah, we agree completely about that. And when we last spoke and you brought up Zen and the Art of Motorcycle Maintenance, the Glass Bead Game, I've actually, I'm back in touch with my oldest childhood friend. He was my closest friend from the age of 4 to the age of 10, and our paths diverged. It was about 20 years since I'd had a conversation with him, and the other week we talked again. And I
Wow.
said to him, you know, when I was about 21, I read Narciss and Goldmund by Hesse. And right then I thought about you and me, because he did a PhD in comparative religion. He became a theological advisor to the Archbishop of Westminster, then the ecumenical advisor to the Archbishop of Canterbury. And so he's a high power theologian. He's been celibate all of his life. And it was that sort of, the warrior who went out into the world, which ended up being me. And it doesn't fit together, but it's meant that I actually went and bought a copy of Narciss and Goldmund. I reread Steppenwolf about 5 years ago at the urging of a friend. So, Crime and Punishment, or The Brothers Karamazov. The Devils. There's an obscure Dostoevsky called A Friend of the Family. And as far as I can tell, it was last translated in 1926. I managed to get a copy because a Russian dear friend of mine, Alexander Dvorkin, who's a professor in Moscow, professor of medieval history, he said, read this Dostoevsky. He's an expert on cults. And Dostoevsky, of course, gives us Dostoevsky syndrome, temporal lobe epilepsy, as it's been renamed. But he also, in Friend of the Family, describes malignant narcissism better than anybody else I have ever seen. And it's a comic novel, but his perception of how we work is just unbelievable. And I think you have to be probably a creative genius to get to that. I think Eric Fromm is one of the few. I suppose Mircea Eliade was a successful novelist as well as one of the great historians of religion, gave us the word shaman along the way. But so sometimes you will get somebody who's working in an academic field who does have a creative talent. But I think that creative insight is important. And, coming away from The Moon and Sixpence by Somerset Maugham, or there are so many novels that give us tremendous insight, and any great work of music or painting or cinema. I recently watched Maestro, the Bradley Cooper, Gary Mulligan film about Bernstein, and I was blown away. It's so beautifully made.
Beautifully made.
And such a tangle when you get inside this promiscuous bisexual man who had such an influence on the world. I was surprised by the music because, I have the sense that if I heard the whole pieces, I probably wouldn't be as taken. But the snippets they give you in the movie are just wonderful.
Wonderful. I had a problem with that movie because I thought it was just everything you said, absolutely. But at the last portion, when we're giving away plots, but there was I won't give away a plot, but there was a portion where he goes to a dance club. And it's way down the end of the line. And I just felt like there was no real, I didn't find, I guess it was real and true, but I just felt so much for his wife.
Yes. And I think that the Carey Mulligan character, the disappointment there was part of the emotional impact.
Yeah.
That coming away going, he was a rotten husband.
Yeah.
And she was an excellent wife, and she really didn't deserve the treatment or indeed the end that she came to. But there's the problem that you are going to be shown things that don't feel right. Have you watched Billions?
I've watched like the first four seasons or something.
That's exactly what I've watched. I've just finished I've got 13 minutes left of the last episode. And it made me think about you, because I've been watching it recently with one of my sons, that these people, the characters on both sides, Paul Giamatti and Damian Lewis, everything is Machiavellian. Everything they do. And it all based on a belief in their own righteousness.
Yeah.
Particularly the Paul Giamatti character who's doing these awful things so that good can triumph, you know?
Yeah.
Oh dear.
Yeah, terrible. Hey, I got to say this just between, I mean, we're recording the show, but I have a movie that I relate to as a former transformed man that really depicts me as a person. I relate to it so fully. And I've shared that when I was younger, having related to it so much as an adult, and not one person I've shared it with has appreciated it or liked it. But it is such a phenomenal film. And since we're talking film, I got Neil Jordan's The Butcher Boy.
Oh, watch that.
Check that out. That's Sean McCraney before his roadside experience.
Well, and I hope to give you a better view of it than anybody else has given. I will. How disappointing.
If it insults you and terrifies you as much as people just, I don't know why. It's a Cillian Murphy, I heard. That's his favorite movie too, though.
Oh, wow. The great Cillian Murphy. Yeah. Peaky Blinders.
Yeah.
I grew up 15 miles away from Birmingham, so I can speak like that if I want to.
Oh, come on and hang out with me. I will massage your back.
Oh, okay. I'm on my way.
Too good.
Right.
Historical? Is that thing historical?
I fear that it is. That and I couldn't believe that it was. It's like, you know, when I saw Gangs of New York and went, oh, that can't be true. And then you go, yep, the costumes, it's all what it was. And yes, the Peaky Blinders did exist. They've changed one letter in their surname, but they existed, and they were Didikoits, gypsies, Romanis, and they ran a vicious gang. And I'm not sure that he ever got to be a member of parliament. That may be made. And there's a subplot in it, which is rather interesting, about Winston Churchill.
Oh, and yeah.
They're murdering people in the Irish Republican Army for Winston Churchill. And if we want to talk about complexity of character, I know nobody. Churchill is the worst of men and the best of men.
Yeah.
And in this country, of course, in 1999, there was a poll, massive poll, to determine who the greatest Briton was. And they decided it was Winston Churchill, which, because he had so many of the characteristics of a sociopath, you know, just quite, he loved fighting, loved battles.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
He said that during the Blitz, the people around him would desperately try to keep him from going on the rooftop so he could watch things exploding. It's like an unusual man in many ways, but positive and brilliant in some ways. But yeah. Murders being committed on behalf of the state against a very dangerous group, but you know, very difficult.
This is very unprofessional, but I got to look at my phone because I want to see a picture I took and ask you if you have read this or heard of it, because it is an exceptional book about people in leadership who are sociopaths. And you could probably cite it. You could probably cite it right now. It's about it's mostly U.S. presidents. I think it might talk about Neville, Chamberlain.
Yeah.
But I don't know. It's just about their effectiveness in office. It's their sociopathy that allows them to be so effective. And would you disagree with that?
Well, I think there is a matter of balance here, that Emory University did a study of US presidents and said that every popular president was a narcissist going back through history. John F. Kennedy would be the supreme example of this. I think that watching Billions, this really struck me, the thought that you have to have a good person who understands the Machiavellian.
Yeah.
That to have a real leader, you have to have somebody who understands that and can transcend that.
Yeah.
And that might very well be a reformed sociopath, because, you know, I can understand it analytically, but it doesn't make sense to me, you know, from the inside. And I think Neville Chamberlain would actually exemplify, he seems to me to have had Asperger's, but he exemplifies somebody who really did understand goodness. and was completely trashed. And let me just sound off about that. That the book that destroyed Chamberlain's reputation, published I think in 1942, so the year after he died, was co-written by Michael Foot, who would later lead the Labour Party. And the book is called The Guilty Men. And they basically blame World War II on Neville Chamberlain and a civil servant whose name I forget. And when you look back, in 1935, when Chamberlain was Secretary of the Treasury, Chancellor of the Exchequer, he's the guy that initiated rearmament. And the Labour Party at that time wanted all of that money to be spent on schools and hospitals. So Britain, under Michael Foot's direction, would have been completely defenceless at the beginning of the war. What's more, Churchill, who of course had stormed out of cabinet in 1931 because there was the decision to give home rule to India. And Churchill was dead against that. You want colonies. So he'd left cabinet. All of this stuff about him being the great opponent of Hitler in Parliament, it's not true. It was Violet Bonham Carter, Helena Bonham Carter's grandmother, who was the great opponent of Hitler. But Churchill campaigned to spend all of that money on bombers, and Chamberlain said, no, we need fighters. And that's what saved Britain in the Battle of Britain.
Look at that. That changes my view in some ways.
Yeah.
The name of the book is A First-Rate Madness.
Oh, I haven't heard that.
By Nasir Ghaemi. Uncovering the link between leadership and mental illness. I highly recommend it.
I will read it. Leadership. Yeah, I have a friend, my good friend Ira Chaleff, who I've known for nearly 50 years now. He brought courageous followership to the table, which is now being used throughout the US military, both military personnel and non-military, which is nearly a million people are being trained in this very sensible way of looking at how you get leaders to behave properly. So the surname again? Have you closed it down now?
Nasir, Nassir, Ghaemi, Ghaemi. New York Times bestseller. I don't know if that helps or hurts.
Yeah, one hates to think. Fantastic.
Yeah.
I think we've conquered evil.
Yeah. And knowing you has improved my life. You're so well read and so knowledgeable, and you're able to take the principles and bring them into such a cohesive, workable explanation. I just really appreciate learning about you, because I'm tapping into a vast amount of work and knowledge. That's always a pleasure. You know, I haven't had to do anything but sit here and talk with you, and I've learned. What a beautiful thing.
Well, and for me too, our encounters, I really looked forward to talking to you today. And my day didn't start well. I wasn't in I had a nightmare and woke up in the middle of that and was feeling a bit grumpy. And then I thought, yeah, but I'll be talking to Sean. So,
I'm glad we can get together. Thanks, my friend.
Great. So let's, we'll exclude the audience and talk privately where they can't see us anymore.
Okay.
Thanks so much to you. And thanks to everybody that's managed to make it through to the end here. And do write some comments, because Sean actually looks at them. Unlike most of the people I talk to, he actually has a look and will respond to questions. I may look at them. I recently have managed to look at a few.
I'd love to.
Great. So thanks everybody for watching, and enjoy your lives.
Yes. Thanks, John.
Hi, John here. Thanks for watching. We'd appreciate it very much if you would click like, as well as subscribe, and click the bell for notifications. Every dollar helps, and we welcome new patrons on Patreon, or you can make a one-off payment with any currency through PayPal. Thanks so much.